It was too dangerous to go there, at least while things were in so much turmoil. She was on her own for the moment. Fortunately, she still had some resources of her own. Not too many, but some. Those would have to be enough. She was desperate, more desperate than any of her potential rivals. And that was a weakness she could turn to a strength, if she could make determination and a refusal to lose work for her. Of such things, power was born. Chapter 30. HWS Leonidor, orbiting planet Farsalon, Atara Mordlin 3, year of renewal 267, 322 AC. The Battle of Farsalon, the attack of the Highborn. Second division, increase thrust to 30%. Fourth division, alter vector plus 40 minus 10 plus 40. Get those ships around and into range. Kronos was snapping out orders, almost without pause. He had enough aides, enough communications officers to relay his commands however quickly he spat them out. But even so, the sweating Kriegeri all around the control room showed the exhaustion they were feeling, the desperate fatigue from keeping up with their commander's frantic pace. Kronos was facing the others for the first time. Perhaps that was why he was so driven, why he defied the sense of hopelessness already working its way through the fleet. He turned off his analytical mind, at least with regard to the force matchups. He didn't need despair. He didn't need to determine his forces had no chance of victory. He had to make a chance somehow. He had to stop the other stone cold before another 300 million citizens and half the antimatter production in the entire hegemony were lost. His demeanor defied the sense of order and intellect that had driven him his entire life, and had released the warrior within, the savage fighter who paid no heed to odds, to technology. That spirit had lived inside him his entire life. It was, no doubt, what had pushed him toward a military life, when at his lofty ranking he could have chosen any profession, or none at all. But what had strengthened it, truly released it, were his experiences on the rim. The Confeds and their allies had fought without pause, without regard for the odds so heavily stacked against them. They had lost battles, lost worlds, including their capital, but they'd continued the fight. Had they analyzed the odds, followed a logical course, they would have surrendered. But they didn't, and they'd become the first known humans to escape absorption. Even in the face of Colossus, they'd stood firm, without any detectable signs they had ever considered yielding. That almost instinctive animalist determination to fight without regard to the losses they endured suggested a lower order of thinking. But that logic had been wrong. The Rim fighters had learned from the hegemony even as they'd battled fiercely. Their engineers had certainly gleaned technological advancements from watching the battles and analyzing what they saw. Kronos had learned some things as well, and first and foremost among those was never to give up. He'd also come to understand that the warrior's urges that lived in him were not antithetical to his ordered mind, that he could release them, draw strength from their power without surrendering his judgment, his incisive thought. He'd never been the underdog before, never faced a superior enemy, and he wondered how he would have handled it if he hadn't witnessed the insane will and courage of the Rim warriors. Farzar and Kirazan have been destroyed, Commander. Two battleships. Kronos stared out at the space where the icons representing the two lost ships had been seconds before. He had his battleships out in front, pressing forward against the enemy, but also acting as a kind of bait. The others mostly disregarded his cruisers and escorts, but they targeted the big battleships moving toward them at high velocities. That was bad in every context save one. It allowed the even larger, more powerful monitors to move forward, to escape fire while they closed to their own firing ranges. It was a cold-blooded tactic, one he'd never had to employ before against mostly overmatched enemies. But the idea of sacrificing battleships to serve as cover chilled his blood, even in his agitated, aggressive state. It was insane, each of the vessels lost representing years of construction and millions of hegemony credits, not to mention over 1,000 trained Kriegeri. But Kronos was certain of one thing, a fact his analytical mind and the warrior side then in control agreed upon. Whatever chance there was of victory, of defeating the others, the cost would be horrendous, like nothing he had seen before, even in the deadly battles on the Rim. All divisions continue thrust and vectors. All units are to follow the tactical plan regardless of losses. His voice was like ice. He glanced to the side of the display, to the large cluster of small ovals a million kilometers behind his fleet. Ilias's ships. Kronos had developed a plan, ordered his second-in-command to remain behind, to wait for an opening to intervene, one he knew might never come. But as he saw more of his ships destroyed and no small number badly damaged, he began to wonder if he'd made the right choice. Could he really afford to keep almost half his strength out of the fight for any amount of time? Out of the fight now, but they'll be up soon enough. Running into a head-to-head brawl isn't going to work, not against the others. Ilias knows what he is doing. He thought about slowing his ships down, about drawing the enemy farther forward. That might help Ilias's fleet gain a positional advantage. No. It's not possible. You have to close. Get your people in this fight, too. If you stay back, let the enemy blast the fleet while you can't shoot back, you're finished. Kronos realized in an instant just how the Confeds, how Tyler Baron had felt, enduring railgun fire as they raced forward to bring their own primary beams into play. And they got through that war. It was a meaningless comparison, of course, but it still helped him. A little. The forward line will prepare to open fire. His first 20 battleships would enter range in less than a minute. First 19. He stared straight ahead, eyes fixed on that thin line of ships and right on the spot where one had been seconds before. He had more strength coming up, the might of the hegemony, massed as it had never been before, but he didn't know if it would be soon enough. One side of his brain said yes, the other no. But none of that mattered. At the very least, the one-sided phase of the battle would soon be over. His ships and people would continue to die, but in a moment, they would start killing as well. Forward line entering range, Commander. Kronos looked ahead, his eyes cold and focused. Open fire. I want those railguns double-shot at Hectoron, and I mean now. Ella sat calmly on her bridge, ignoring the danger from the withering enemy fire, brushing away the dark cloud of despair, even then eroding the morale of her spacers. They could take it, she knew. Kriegeri were raised for military service, and often committed to their units at young ages. They were tough to break. But the carnage unfolding all around was wearing them down. Yes, Commander. The officer sounded just a bit uncertain. Most of Hellas' people were veterans from the Rim War, and they'd all seen the Confeds and their allies exceeding the recommended energy levels, overpowering their guns to increase effectiveness in battle. But loading two antimatter canisters into a railgun designed to take one was something else entirely. As far as Hellas knew, it had never been tried. She'd made an effort at analysis, tried to do some quick calculations to determine if the weapons, or the ships that carried them, could stand the strain. But then she looked up at the display, saw her ships being blasted to scrap. She gave the order anyway. They were all going to die if she did nothing, and if there was no escape, she damn sure intended to drag some of the others down to hell with her. She'd volunteered to command the advance force. Hell, she'd beg Kronos to give it to her. He'd been hesitant, no doubt knowing just what the loss rates were likely to be, but he'd given in. He probably hadn't had much choice. Her role in pulling the forces back from Ventator Conus had made her somewhat of a hero. Kronos had asked her if she was sure one last time, and then he'd approved her request. She regretted it, a little and on some deep and submerged level. But even as she sat there, watching her ships destroyed all around her and resorting to increasingly desperate actions, she knew she would do it all over again if she had the chance. This wasn't an absorption attempt like the Rim War had been, not a typical conflict. It was a fight to the finish, and there was no other place she could be except in the leading wave. Gunnery reports double-loaded batteries ready to fire. Amaliar and Walesia are also ready. She looked straight ahead. Her ships had been firing for 10 minutes, and they'd scored a number of hits. There were two enemy vessels showing signs of significant damage. That was something, and better than anything she'd seen in Ventator Conus, but it wasn't enough. Not even close. Even with Kronos's main force coming into the battle, adding their fire to that of her ships, she had to do better. Hectoron. Fire. What the hell was that? Kronos had been moving his eyes across the display, alternating between watching Hellas' ships get blasted to scrap and turning away when he couldn't take it anymore. But something had just happened, something different, and though he'd seen it, he couldn't bring himself to believe it. He needed to be sure. A few seconds later, he was. Enemy vessel destroyed, Commander. We have multiple confirmations. Kronos heard the words and he'd seen the ship disappear from the display with his own eyes, but he still had trouble acknowledging what had just happened. Somehow it didn't seem quite real. Several hegemony forces had faced the others before the current fight, with no confirmed kills to show for the losses they suffered. He'd come to Atara Mordlin with the intention of ending that streak, of destroying many enemy ships. Now he realized some part of him at least hadn't really expected to achieve that goal. In spite of all his bravado and confidence, he found himself surprised his people had scored a kill. However close the others were to Untouchable, it was now clear that was the one thing they were not. Hellas had just proven that. One ship destroyed was far from decisive or even tactically important, but it was first blood, and in a situation where real doubt had existed about the enemy's vulnerability, that was everything. It was hope. It was a reason to fight on, to pour everything into the struggle. The loss ratios were still abysmal. Over 40 hegemony ships crippled or destroyed so far, for the one vessel Hellas' task force had just destroyed. But it wasn't about ratios, not in this instance. Hellas had proven again the targeting revisions worked. But for all of that, there was something else, something Kronos couldn't quite place. That enemy ship was destroyed too quickly. Commander, the scanner readings are very confusing. We tracked two shots that struck the enemy ship and...
And?
Kronos' tone was sharp, demanding. It was no time for his aides to sit in stunned silence. He needed information. According to our scanner replays, both Hisarius and Volcom scored railgun hits, but their projectiles appear to have inflicted damage far beyond any projections. Data reviews of the inbound paths indicate the weapon's velocity significantly exceeded standard levels. Exceeded? How do you explain that, Hectoron?
I cannot, Commander. I apologize.
Kronos didn't respond, not right away. The Kriegeri were admirable in most cases, at least to his sensibilities, but they could sometimes become a bit obsequious, especially around high-level masters when they didn't have information that was requested or demanded. Some masters were less patient with their subordinates than Kronos considered appropriate. He didn't tolerate it in his command, at least when he saw it, but he knew it happened. Kronos also knew he couldn't expect the officer to have the answers. He didn't have them himself yet. No apology necessary, Hectoron. Let us work the problem. Divert all data flow from the scanner array and the replays to the main AI. I want answers and I want them now.
Yes, Commander.
The officer turned and leaned over his station, carrying out Kronos' command to the letter. Perhaps half a minute later, he had an answer. At almost the same moment, the solution suddenly appeared in his own mind. And it all made sense. A terrifying, dangerous kind of sense.
Commander, the AI theorizes that Commander Hellas' ships are...
Yes, Hectoron, I know. I know exactly what they are doing. And God help them. God help us all. Baron watched the battle unfold on the display, his attention riveted, even as he marshaled every bit of strength inside him to stay where he was, to keep his fleet back at the transit point. It went against everything he believed to hold back and watch an ally's ships being savaged, even when that ally still seemed half like an enemy. He had his orders, and they'd been given to him in clear and precise terms, written skillfully enough to deny him any possible justification for misunderstanding. One by one, the ships of the Hegemony Advance Force were obliterated, even as they stayed grimly in the fight, inflicting their own damage on the deadly enemy. Then something changed. The impacts from the Hegemony railguns increased in intensity. The energy readings were tentative, certainly at the distance from Baron ships to the battle underway, but the spike was sharp and noticeable. The Hegemony railguns were somehow hitting harder. Baron was confused, at least until he saw the data on the projectiles heading toward the enemy fleet. The velocities were enormous, almost 300th the speed of light. That was far greater than any of his ships had faced during the war, a difference he found inexplicable. Had the Hegemony made a breakthrough of some kind, an advance in their weapons technology? One Akella had kept secret. No, that doesn't make sense. She would know we'd see the increased capability, so why hide something? His thoughts stopped cold as realization set in. They're overpowering their guns. Baron knew the concept well. He'd used it multiple times, usually to good effect, though not without consequences, burned and scarred crew, even destroyed ships. Weapons were rated for maximum power outputs, and moving beyond those levels increased the risk of burnouts, and even catastrophic malfunctions. But Baron's experiences had been limited to running increased energy levels through conduits into his primaries and lasers. The Hegemony railguns were powered by antimatter and... They're increasing the antimatter loads. It suddenly made sense. And it didn't. Feeding more juice into a particle accelerator was one thing, but the railguns blasted chunks of super-hard metal out into space.
The basic system was already hard on the surrounding structure, one reason only hegemony capital ships carried the great weapons. How much more can those hulls take? As if in answer to his thought, one of the forward hegemony ships disappeared, but not from enemy fire this time. A few seconds later, another one blinked off the large screen. He watched, shocked on one level at the recklessness of such tactics, but realizing on another he would almost certainly have done the same thing. The results at least were clear. The hegemony forward line was drawing blood, though it was bleeding itself to do it, and much more quickly. He didn't know the technology that powered the enemy railguns, not all of it at least. But he knew enough to realize the only thing the hegemony vessels could have done was to jam more antimatter into their guns. That had to be dangerous. Antimatter was the most powerful and volatile fuel known to human science, and Kronos's people were taking wild chances with it. Baron's insides froze. He wanted to wonder how the hegemony warriors had become so desperate. But he knew already. He knew because he'd been there. He remembered making similar decisions, watching ships destroyed and crews killed because they'd followed his orders, tore up their safety manuals and done as he'd told them to do. His people had destroyed countless more hegemony vessels through such tactics than they might have otherwise, but they'd paid for it as well. Paid dearly. Now it was the hegemony's turn to learn what that felt like. Part of Baron experienced a grim satisfaction at seeing his old enemy driven to the desperate kind of tactics his own spacers had been compelled to employ. He knew that was pointless, that such kinds of gratification always carried a terrible cost. He was watching his old enemy struggle to survive, but his eyes were clear enough to see the future as well as the present, the inevitable vision of his own people fighting the same new enemy, struggling to find their own ways to battle them at whatever cost. Just as they'd done before. But he knew it would be even worse this time. Damage control teams to gunnery. All ships, I want engineering parties posted to all railguns. I expect those weapons to keep firing whatever it takes. Hellas felt a rush, a burst of excitement. Her makeshift tactic was working, at least where it wasn't blasting her ships to plasma. She would be in the history texts now. If there are any history texts. Her forces had become the first to destroy one of the other ships. It was noteworthy, and she and her people would be feted for their achievement. If any of them made it out of the current fight, which seemed like a shaky prospect. Commander, we've got multiple reports coming in. Damage to rail guns, casualties among the crews. We can't maintain full fire. All shots with double loads. Hellas wasn't oblivious to the hell she was inflicting on her gunners. Several of the task force's batteries had been destroyed by the overpowered shots, their crews wiped out before any had even had a chance to escape. Others were damaged, some knocked out of action for the duration, others with some hope of quick repair. And two ships were gone, destroyed outright as the overloaded antimatter canisters lost containment and annihilated. Damage or no damage, she also knew all of her crews had been bathed in radiation as they'd worked feverishly in the raging heat of the contaminated gunnery stations. The shielding around the railguns was thick enough to offer protection against normal shots, but her double-powered blasts were almost certainly pushing hard gamma rays into her ships. But the tactic, deadly, dangerous, costly, was also working. The double-shotted railgun rounds had better than half again the velocity of normal shots. They ripped through space that much faster, confounding the enemy's evasive routines and scoring hits at better than double the rate of unmodified weapons. The shots hit harder, too. The kinetic energy imparted to the target almost twice as great. Even the enemy ships, for all their technological superiority, suffered when one of those deadly chunks of super-heavy metal struck. No physical construct ever known could absorb such a hit without buckling, melting, vaporizing. Ellis's best guess was three of the enemy ships had been badly damaged, two of those so badly they were no longer firing, in addition to the one vessel destroyed. Then, even as she sat there staring right at the display, a second enemy ship winked out of existence. She felt a rush of exhilaration, one that almost sent her leaping from her chair. But the joy was short-lived. Less than 30 seconds later, two more of her own ships were destroyed, and a third was close, its broken hull bleeding atmosphere, even as its crew frantically tried to restore basic power and maneuver. Still, however grim the situation, it couldn't dampen the satisfaction of seeing enemy ships destroyed. What she had done, others could do. And that meant whether she survived the battle or not, the war wasn't over. The hegemony would fight on, with some chance at least, some way to hurt the enemy. She heard the distant rattle as Vigalator's railguns fired again, and seconds later she saw the impact, as 1,000 kilograms of high-density metal slammed into an enemy ship. The mysterious vessel shuddered, and then it just hung there, looking very much like it was dead in space. She clenched her fists in silent celebration, even as she turned toward her damage control screen, closing her eyes for an instant as she saw the sheer mass of warnings and red status icons scrolling down the page. That last shot had caused a deadly backblast of radiation, and 12 systems had shorted out. Vigalator had led the first attack to destroy an enemy vessel. But now the flagship itself was in trouble, the deep wound a self-inflicted one. Ellis had known the risks of her reckless tactic, and they had struck home. She was still reading the reports and snapping out orders to her engineering teams when a deep explosion shook Vigalator, and every light on the bridge went dark. "Commander Hellas is insane, Megaron. 3 of her ships have been destroyed by railgun backfires. Her tactics are working. Commander Hellas is showing us the way, Killeron. All ships are to double load their railgun batteries. We will be in range in 2 minutes, and it's time we did some damage to the enemy. Some real damage." Cronus's tone was hard, his displeasure with the Kriegery Killeron becoming clear with every word. But still the officer continued. "Megaron, we can't— Was some part of my order unclear, Killeron?" Cronus's voice was loud, booming, every bit of the pride and authority that went with his position as number 8 of the hegemony utterly apparent.
"No, Commander. Certainly not."
The officer sounded terrified, scared of Cronus now even more than he was of the enemy.
"Relaying your orders, Commander."
Cronus didn't respond. He just looked out, watching the shattered remnants of Hellas's force fighting on grimly, even as his own line came up behind them. Vigalator was along the front of the formation, but it was clear the battleship was badly damaged. Cronus had watched as the battered ship fired again and scored a deadly hit. But it was the last shot Vigalator had managed. Hellas's flagship had wounded itself, possibly mortally. He had no idea how the ship was still there, or what had kept her main guns firing for so long. He'd almost have believed it was a manifestation of the pure stubbornness of his vanguard commander. Hellas had done more than he could have hoped, served with courage and distinction. She was a hero, even if she had lost 60% of her ships so far. But she'd drawn blood, 4 enemy ships destroyed outright, and at least 12 others with measurable damage. That was still an uneven exchange, and yet it was better than Cronus had dared to imagine. And he was leading more than 100 battleships and monitors into the fight, throwing a massive portion of hegemony power at the enemy. More than 100,000 Kriegery and 200 Masters manned those capital ships, and thousands more the escorts accompanying them. Ellis had shown the way, desperate though it was. Now Cronus was going to put some real force behind it. Chapter 31 Confederation Naval HQ, Troyes City, Megara Oleus 3, Year 322 AC. "Senator Flandry, I want to be sure there is no confusion between us, so I'm afraid I may be rather blunt. Tyler is out there with a relatively small fleet. His reports leave little doubt this new incursion is a threat to the Confederation, and indeed the entire Rim as well as the hegemony. Yet the Senate debates endlessly with no vote in sight, and no certainty there will even be an authorization for the military to prepare to dispatch the fleet to hegemony space to Tyler's aid."
"Captain Lafarge, I'm delighted to see you."
The Senate speaker addressed Andy by her naval rank, though she'd reverted to an active status just after the end of the war with the hegemony. The form of address was proper and no doubt his effort to be as respectful as possible to her, but somehow it just pissed her off. If she was being honest with herself, she'd have admitted that anything except a total and complete and immediate acceptance of all her requests, demands really, would have angered her. But she'd come to try to reason with a politician, somewhat of an ally of convenience to Tyler, at least before she took other measures. "Before we get to the business you came to discuss, allow me to congratulate you. Another generation of Barons is a cause for the entire Confederation to celebrate."
"Thank you, Speaker."
It was a short, abrupt response, but it was the best she could manage. Andy was hiding multiple causes of annoyance. First, she'd have preferred that no one knew she was pregnant, and certainly not before she had the chance to tell Tyler. She tended to despise the sort of perfunctory well wishes commonly offered by people who simply were not a real part of her life. She considered every word she heard to be insincere, unless she had good reason to believe otherwise, and she found engaging in the choreographed dance of fake social interactions tiring. She wouldn't have ventured out at all, most likely, if Tyler hadn't needed her. But he did. And that being the case, there was no prison cell that could have held her, much less the palatial hotel suite that still served as home. Not to be rude, Speaker, but if possible, I would like to return to the matter at hand. Tyler led the mission to Hegemony Space as requested by the Senate. He has investigated as he was sent to do, and he has sent back his report. It has been days now, and yet there has been no action. She was trying to keep her tone measured, her demeanor diplomatic, but the edge that always crept into her voice in tense situations was there. Andy looked as harmless as she ever had, a pregnant woman, unarmed and there expressing concern for her spouse. At least she appeared unarmed, the one weapon she carried, and it had been a very long time since Andy had gone anywhere completely unarmed, was very cleverly concealed. Still, she could see beyond Flandry's reflexive charm. The speaker was a bit intimidated. It didn't matter how harmless she looked, how pregnant she was. Andy was still the woman who'd killed Ricard Lié, and that reputation would follow her to her grave. Andy, I can assure you, I am Tyler's ally in all of this. Your ally. A pause, which Andy knew, served as one massive but. There are problems, however. You can understand the reluctance of many to present their constituents with the prospect of a new war so soon after all the hardship and strife of the recently concluded conflict. I have made every effort to accede to Tyler's requests. I have not brought the matter to a vote yet for a simple reason. I do not, at this time, have enough support to guarantee approval. I can promise you I will keep trying. Given time, I believe we can reach the desired result. I urge you to be patient. Patient was the one thing Andy had never been, and she damn sure wasn't going to start while Tyler and his people were in danger so far from home. But ally or not, and she still wasn't sure, she realized she'd gotten everything she was going to get from Flandry. She believed the speaker had tried to gather the needed support, and that he'd failed. And he wasn't sure, of course. Flandry could just be full of shit. That was probably a coin toss, she figured, but it didn't matter. Refusal to try and failure were functionally the same thing in this case, and that only left her one choice. It was a sort of nuclear option, something that would cause the pompous politicians in the Senate to lose their minds. But it was impossible to express how little Andy cared what the senators liked or hated. It was time to press the button, time to launch everything she had. No, Clint, not yet. Tyler wouldn't want that. Andy paused. Baron wouldn't want his friends taking crazy risks for him, no matter how deeply he was in danger. Andy was having none of that, of course. She was going to get him help one way or another, but before she let Winters bring the fleet to Megara and send Marines into the Senate compound, she had another idea. Get everything as ready as you can just in case, but I think I have a plan, a less disruptive one. Winters nodded slowly. Okay, Andy, but don't wait too long. If I have to take action, I will need some time. And we don't know what is happening out at Calphron, or how much trouble Tyler's facing. A pause. Or for that matter, how much of a threat is building against all of us. Andy reached out and put her hand on Winters' shoulder. The Admiral, Tyler's second in command, was one of the few people she considered a true friend. And his loyalty to Tyler was beyond question. It wasn't every day you found a friend ready to commit mutiny and treason to help you, after all. But Andy knew what she was going to do. It wasn't much subtler, but it was a bit more elegant and far less destructive. And it had the advantages of not requiring its participants to commit capital crimes and not risking an outbreak of civil war. I'm not going to wait. We have to get help to Tyler as quickly as possible, and I think my way will be quicker than yours. She paused and looked at Winters. But what you're willing to do, Clint, I'll never forget it. She stood there wordlessly for a few seconds. Then she turned toward Gary Holston. The spymaster had been standing there, quietly listening. His job description included stopping plots like the one Winters was prepared to attempt, but Holston had always had his own interpretation of duty. And he knew without a doubt if it came to armed action, Confederation intelligence wouldn't interfere, and would probably help Winters' mutineers. In addition to Holston's recognition of the danger and his respect and admiration for Tyler Baron, he owed Andy. She knew the spymaster still carried guilt for sending her to Danith, for the torture and interrogations she endured. She'd never held him to blame. When she agreed to do something, she took the responsibility herself. But she wasn't above using it to get what she wanted from him. If she had to work him, and she didn't think that would be necessary, the pregnancy would only add to her manipulation arsenal. Gary, I need your help. She hesitated, trying to get a read on what he was thinking. She was sure enough he would help her, but his expression was impassive. pulsed into just about the best poker face she'd ever seen. Tyler's was legendary too, at least in the fleet, but it didn't work on her. She knew him too well. And he was always just a little bit flustered around her. It was one of the first things that attracted her to him. If you've got some way to avoid the other option, I'm ready to do whatever I can. He'd carefully avoided any indication he would oppose outright mutiny, but he hadn't acknowledged support for it either. You've got some connections, both as head of Confederation Intelligence and through the Holston family investments. We might be able to combine those to get what we need. Anyone I can reach or pressure, you know I will, Andy. We can apply some considerable force, if needed, to secure cooperation, up to and including a room full of agents shoving guns down people's throats. I don't even think that will be necessary, Gary. The people I need will be ecstatic about doing what I want them to do. It's the kind of thing they dream about. We just need to reach the decision-makers, quickly. Andy walked down the corridor, deep in thought, ignoring the small cluster of people around her as she finalized in her mind just what she was going to say. Her stomach was roiling and it took a fair amount of effort to keep everything down. It wasn't nerves. It wasn't just nerves. Andy wasn't one prone to being badly affected by stress. She'd faced death numerous times without so much as a stomach ache to show for it. But pregnancy was proving to be a different experience. She imagined laying guilt trips on her future son or daughter. She hadn't even taken the time to find out what she was carrying, recounting in excruciating detail every moment she spent doubled over, emptying her guts of what seemed like 5 times the volume she'd put in. Andy was a warrior at heart, a killer. She was a Badlands prospector, an adventurer, and a quasi-criminal turned naval officer. But one thing she'd never imagined, not in all her days scavenging on the streets of her homeworld, nor deep in the bowels of some imperial artifact, was being a mother. It seemed almost an alien concept, and while deep down there was happiness, it was held back by pain and worry over Tyler's absence. And by the fact that she had no idea what to do with a child. She was as far from maternal by nature as anyone she'd ever known, and she doubted any of the things she was good at, the basics of knife fighting, for example, would make for ideal mother-child bonding experiences. What stories would she tell a child? Would she recount all the Badlands border scumbags she'd put into the ground, tried to describe the look of pure astonishment and terror in Ricard Lié's eyes when she killed him? She pulled herself back into the present. She was standing in front of a door at the end of the hallway. It was time. Captain, this is the main broadcast center. When you are inside and ready to begin, simply wave your hand and the broadcast will begin. It will go live throughout Megara and be immediately transmitted to the other planets of the system, as well as all space stations and ships in transit or port. It will go to other systems as well, right? Yes. Our broadcasts go to every planet in the Confederation. As soon as the signal reaches the telecom station positioned at each transit point, it'll be recorded and sent through via drone. The transmission will then be sent across that system to all worlds and other pockets of habitation, as well as to the telecom stations at the other transit points in that system. The time to receipt and rebroadcast varies. The transmission will reach orbital stations around Megara and nearby ships in a matter of seconds, and the outer planets and moons in just under 6 hours. Complete transmission to every inhabited world in the Confederation takes a little less than 8 days. Andy nodded. Thank you. In other circumstances, she might have found a detailed description of the Confederation's communications lines interesting, but her mind was elsewhere at that moment. She walked through the door into a large room with a high ceiling. There were immense screens on each of the walls, larger even than the main display on Dauntless. And in the middle of the room, there was a single podium. She walked over to it and stepped up onto a small raised dais. She took a deep breath, fighting off another wave of nausea as she did. Then she stood silently for a moment gathering her thoughts. She'd faced the worst violence humanity could concoct, but the thought of speaking to the entire Confederation suddenly seemed daunting. You hope you're speaking to the entire Confederation. The Senate could cut the broadcast if they act fast enough. There was no way for the Senate or any other authorities to send orders to stop the transmission, at least none that could travel from system to system any faster than her signal. Quick action, getting word to the telecom station to stop the drone before it transited, would be the only chance. That was why she'd scheduled it for this moment, when every senator was in the compound, debating the very issue that concerned her. Why the head of Confederation Intelligence was going to create a power failure on the compound grounds, plunging the politicians and their staffs into total darkness, and subjecting them to a short communications blackout. She wanted the senators to hear what she had to say. In fact, she was counting on it. She just wanted a little delay, just long enough to eliminate the chance of any trickery, any efforts by the Senate to violate the free communications laws of the Confederation. When they saw what she had to say, and realized that the hundreds of billions in the Confederation were going to see the same transmission, they would capitulate. She was as sure of that as she'd ever been of anything. Either that or they would face the wrath of voters for forsaking the Confederation's greatest military hero and ignoring the pleas of his pregnant wife. She waved her hand, and an instant later, she cleared her throat. "Citizens of the Confederation, greetings. My name is Captain Andy LaFarge, and among other things, I am the wife of Admiral Tyler Barron. I am here now to tell you of the situation the Admiral currently faces, and about delays in sending aid to them, and also of the malfeasance and incompetence of the Senate in ensuring the safety of the Confederation and the Rim."
Chapter 32. HWS Leonidor, orbiting planet Pharsalon, Atara Mordlin 3, year of renewal 267, 322 AC. The Battle of Pharsalon, the Inferno. Kronos had never seen carnage like that unfolding all around him, not even in the worst battles on the Rim. His ships were deep in the fight, all that remained of his battleships and monitors deep in range and returning the enemy fire. They were scoring hits and killing enemy vessels, but the cost was almost beyond imagining. The Kriegeri were fighting heroically, their skill and steadfastness a validation in Kronos's mind of the hegemonic system. Those warriors were doing what they'd been born to do, what their natural skill sets allowed them to do. And for all the Rim dwellers considered the genetic rankings somehow evil, there was little or no resentment for the system among the hegemony's residents. Society was well-ordered, its residents funneled into roles they could handle, jobs and responsibilities within the range of their abilities. And of course, those who'd been absorbed during their lifetimes knew another way, the barbarism and misery of so many worlds in the aftermath of the Great Death. Hegemonic rule brought structure, and if it curtailed some level of unrestrained freedom, it traded food and shelter and medicine for it, and allowed those absorbed to live lives of plenty, supported by technology. Few in the history of the hegemony had rebelled against such a trade. At least before the Rim Dwellers, but they didn't suffer as most of the others did. They may call the Great Death the Cataclysm, but what they think of from that terrible time was nothing compared to what Worlds Coreward endured. Kronos winced as another of his monitors blinked off the display. It was a rare expression of emotion, at least while he was on duty. Masters, too, were compelled to play their own role in the hegemony, and as number 8 and commander of the fleet, Kronos was barred from being human, from expressing fear or weakness. His people had to see him as a rock, unbreakable. They had to draw strength from him, power to face the mysterious and deadly enemy. As he watched the battle ranging, he could see his officers, his division commanders, developing their own tactics to fight the others. The enemy was advanced, their might overpowering, but as he saw the ingenuity of his people, the creativity of their maneuvers, he felt something vaguely like hope the hegemony could learn to defeat the enemy. "If we last long enough, and we can't do it alone." He was more certain than ever that his people needed help. Even the wildly creative maneuvers he was watching were not things he could credit solely to the Kriegeri's training or the Master's intellect. He believed in hegemonic society, but he could see the weakness in it as well. Placing someone in a genetically predetermined role eliminated incentives to progress farther. His commanders had learned the wild battle tactics he was viewing, not on their own, but out on the Rim, from the Confeds and their allies. The societies on the Rim seemed bizarre to Kronos. But he couldn't argue that the wild scrum for position and prestige, one that was open to anyone with a drive and energy to pursue what he or she wanted, created a kind of feral energy, one that seemed to spur creativity. "We're better for our interaction with them, however unfortunate the circumstances." His eyes moved to the extreme end of the display. There were roughly 60 small symbols there, clustered around the transit tube. Barron's Confed ships. Kronos had done all he could to convince Barron the Confederation and its allies had to join the fight, but as he sat there, watching his unit commanders behaving a lot like Barron's subordinates, he suddenly knew with unexplained certainty. "We need each other. It's the only way we can win this war." He saw the way the cultures complemented each other, and after 6 years of war against the hegemony, no one knew how to face a technologically superior enemy like the Rim Dwellers.
His hands tightened on the armrests as Leonidor shook. For an instant, Kronos thought his flagship had been badly hit, but the damage control reports quickly put his mind at ease. One of the deadly enemy beams had grazed the vessel, slicing open some outer compartments and overloading part of the scanner array. That was close. Kronos held his cold, impassive pose, but inside, he was shaken. If that shot had been 100 meters or so toward the ship's insides, Leonidor could very well be a cloud of dust and plasma. His people were hurting the enemy, but their losses were too high. They couldn't hold. He needed Ilias's forces. Now. He looked along the display, toward the large cluster of small circles, the 300 ships he'd positioned behind. Ilias's command. It was time to call his second into the fight. But his eyes stopped cold, just short of where he'd intended to look. The tiny dots were out of position. Ilias was already on the move. Antoine, get your squadron together. We're running a preparedness drill. Jake Stockton stood out in the hall, speaking softly, as he gave Blue Squadron's current commander an order. His old command would always hold a special place in his heart, but even though the squadron remained Dauntless's senior formation, it carried no resemblance to the pack of hungry wolves he'd commanded so long ago. The Blue Squadron had been the creation of the young Raptor Stockton, the pilot who had feared nothing, who defied an enemy to dare take a shot at him. That kind of unrestrained bravado was the province of those younger than the current Stockton, of those who had seen a good deal less death and suffering. "I don't understand, Admiral. You mean now? While the battle is going on? That's somewhat of a surprise, isn't it? Do you understand what readiness means, Lieutenant? How much warning do you expect when I am testing your ability to respond under difficult and surprise conditions? But there was nothing on the comm, Admiral, no alert status or other orders. I just gave you your orders, Lieutenant, and unless you want to spend the next 10 years hauling radioactive waste on a scut cargo shuttle, you will follow them, without further questions. Yes, Admiral. Good. Now, see that you've got your people down in the bay and ready in 15 minutes, and alert your flat crews. I want you all in place and your fighters ready to go on a moment's notice. It's time we got past lazy celebrations and remembered we're all warriors. Yes, Admiral, at once. But Stockton could barely hear the words. He turned around even as he was still speaking, and by the time the stunned officer replied, he was already back out in the corridor. He had 5 other squadron leaders to visit, and it was time-consuming doing it without the comm. But if he used the regular lines, someone beside his pilots and flight crews might hear. He knew the rules of engagement and what Admiral Barron was and wasn't allowed to do. But Stockton believed in being prepared for whatever happened, and he'd seen nothing in the rules that prohibited some impromptu training exercises. It was of no matter if said drills left his fighters fueled and armed and ready to launch. He'd managed to get the word to 6 of the other ships via shuttles and trusted officers. That was far from the fleet's entire fighter strength, of course, but it was 36 squadrons, 6 full wings, that would be fully prepared, ready to launch on an instant's notice. Just in case Tyler Barron decides to interpret his orders with a bit of creativity. All ships, this is Commander Ilias. You all know why we're here and what is at stake. This system is vital to our defensive efforts, and it is also on a direct line to Calphuron. We must hold here. We must drive the enemy back. You can see the losses our comrades have suffered, and also the damage they have inflicted on the enemy. It is time. Time for us to come to their aid. Time to drive the enemy back. Ilias had never been one to give stirring speeches to his warriors. It had never really been the hegemony way. But he'd listened to some of the rousing comments Tyler Barron and his comrades had made during the war. At first he'd assumed such things worked in the chaotic atmosphere of the Rim Nations and their armed forces, but that they'd be misplaced in the well-ordered hegemony service. But now he was leading his Kriegery into a battle he knew was almost hopeless. He'd almost been paralyzed by his own fear, and he'd taken a lesson from that. Kriegery were chosen for their genetic suitability for battle, and they were flawlessly trained. But they were still human beings. If Ilias himself was not immune to fear, neither were his spacers. They needed his encouragement, the excitement he could rouse inside them. They need me to lie to them, to tell them we have a chance to win the victory here. He hid his own dark thoughts, and he held back the cold fear still pressing against his defenses. The fleet was drawing blood from the enemy, and that was good news. But it didn't take a master-level mathematician to see where the loss ratios would lead. The fleet couldn't win. The choice would come down to retreat or extermination. He didn't know which he would choose if he commanded the fleet. His fear wanted him to run, to order the ships he led to make a mad dash for the transit tube. But some part of him saw the relief in a glorious death, in fighting to the end. He couldn't decide if that was the courageous option, or a coward's way out of a war he was sure his people would lose. Fortunately, Kronos was in command. Ilias was grateful he had so few options himself. All that had been left to him was to choose his axis of advance, and he'd done that with all the skill and intellect he could muster. He was throwing all his ships against the enemy's extreme left wing. If his ships could get up to the line quickly enough, they just might enjoy local force superiority, at least for a little while. He turned toward his chief aide. All ships are to increase thrust to full power. He intended to minimize the time his ships were vulnerable to the enemy guns while still outside their own firing range, even if that meant his ships would engage in high velocities and zip right past the enemy ships. That would make withdrawal more difficult and risk trapping his entire force, but it exchanged a respite from almost certain heavy losses for possible future danger. That was a deal Ilias was prepared to accept. He nodded as his aide passed on acknowledgements from the various subunits of the fleet. Then he took a deep breath. His ships were entering the enemy's firing range. He'd done all he could to minimize the duration, to prepare his vessels for maximum evasive maneuvers. There was nothing left but to run the guns. To blast forward at full until his ships were close enough to open fire and make the fight a truly two-sided one.
The hegemony fighters are exhibiting a greater degree of unpredictability than we projected. Our losses are considerably higher than even the most pessimistic forecasts.
Tesseract sat at one end of a large, polished metal table, his immense form casting a 3-meter shadow across the floor as he addressed his comrades, the Supreme Council of the Pacification.
"I concur, Grand Admiral."
Phaserax's voice was deeper even than Tesseract's. His position as head of the Church gave him final authority on all matters dealing with the lower creatures of the hegemony and the other formal Imperial sectors.
"Our scouting mission of a century ago suggested no such flexibility of thought, and projections strongly indicated the hegemonic society would have become less flexible, more calcified than what we are witnessing here. That assumption, for unknown reasons, has proven to be incorrect. They are still no threat, of course, to your forces, Grand Admiral, not in any real sense. Our losses, while unexpected, can be replaced, and I do not perceive any sequence of events in which they are able to make a real stand against our forces. My concern lies elsewhere, in the aftermath of conquest. We determined that the hegemonic society was one well-ordered to produce new slaves to sustain our growth and expansion, one reason we allowed it to exist for so long, to develop on its existing course. We expected to find human beings with considerable drone-like characteristics, accustomed to close direction, and yet as the battle continues, we are witnessing no small degree of independent initiative. I'd always expected we would have to terminate all or most of the masters, but now I find myself speculating about what degree of harsh measures will be required to return the lower castes to a state of pure obedience. Your concerns are valid, of course, High Priest, and such decisions, when the time comes, will be largely yours to make. Yet perhaps the problem is not as severe as it might appear. Analysis of the systems we have encountered to date suggests that hegemony population levels exceed our estimates, perhaps by a considerable margin. Even if we are compelled to terminate larger numbers than expected to break any resistance, I am confident that more than enough will remain for our purposes. There may even be utility to it all in the end. A properly broken population may be more adeptly directed to their new purposes than one that is merely docile to start. As long as there is an excess of population, there is little real concern if termination levels are doubled or even tripled. I am inclined to concur, Tesseract, though I believe you are correct to call this assembly, that the matter was at least worthy of discussion. Are all present in agreement with the Grand Admiral's assessment, its resolution that the pacification proceed in accordance with the original plan? A round of acknowledgements moved down the table with almost perfect order and timing. It was unanimous. Very well, then.
Tesseract bowed his head to those gathered around him.
My thanks to each of you for this unscheduled meeting. I wanted to confirm that we were all in agreement before I proceeded to increase the intensity of operations in this system. Specifically, with the High Priest's agreement, I plan to launch an extermination assault against both the inhabited planet and also the 7th satellite of the star, which our scanners indicate contains a primitive antimatter production facility. It is now clear why the hegemonic forces chose this system to make a stand, and my analysis is the simultaneous destruction of a major population center and the elimination of what must be a significant percentage of their antimatter production can only serve to further unnerve and distract the forces now engaged with our fleet. Everyone present gestured affirmatively. Then a moment later, Phaserax spoke.
You indeed have my consent, Deserax. Proceed as you see fit, with the full blessing of this council.
The Grand Admiral rose, his immense form towering over the table.
Once again, my thanks to all of you. The enemy has called forth its reserves. All of its forces, save only for the small armada remaining at the jump point, are now committed and deep within the system. I have given the orders for the final phase. If fortune is with us, the bulk of the hegemony fleet will be destroyed in this system in the next hours.
We stand with you, Grand Admiral. Go with the support of all on this council. The lower creatures in the system are expendable, and the destruction of enemy antimatter production is a first-order priority.
Chapter 33 Stalia Vente Hospital, Liberté City, Planet Mont-Morau, Gassara 4, Uninir 225, 321 AC.
First Citizen, can you hear me?
The words were soft, distant. Villeneuve was floating, drifting along a cool breeze, lost, uncertain of where he was. He reached out, tried to follow the voice, to find his way back to. To what? He didn't know. Or did he? There was something else, something new. Anger? Was it new? Or was it old, just returning? His view changed, morphing from a soft, gauzy haze to a harsh, bright light. And beyond, faces, blurry at first, but slowly coming into focus.
Where?
He croaked out the one-word question, his throat aching as he did.
You're in the hospital, First Citizen.
How? Why?
There was an explosion, a nuclear accident. The hull of the people has gone, First Citizen, and most of the surrounding buildings. You were leaving early. You're outside, close, but partially protected from the primary blast zone. I found you there, got you away.
Oh. Ah, you.
Then before the man responded.
Steves?
Yes, First Citizen. It's Gravis Steves. I was able to contact your elite guards. There are 50 of them here. They're patrolling all around the hospital. You're safe.
For now, maybe.
Clarity was returning, and with it an irresistible urge, a yawning need to act, to take steps to preserve his power.
Ciara?
As far as I've heard, she is still missing. She must be dead, sir.
Can't assume that. Who is running government?
As far as anyone knows, you are, First Citizen. I put out word that you were in your bunker managing a response to this atrocity. So far, it seems to be working.
No. Won't stop anyone. Blood's already in works.
Villeneuve turned his head to the side, and the room flipped upside down. He could feel the vomit rising, and he tried to turn over before it came up, with limited success. He retched hard, and he felt the warm froth sliding down his neck and onto his shoulders.
Please, First Citizen, you have to remain still. You've had a preliminary radiation cleanse, but I'm afraid you're still suffering from the effects of the contamination.
Go. Get out of here.
The command was directed at the nurse trying to clean up the mess he'd made. Villeneuve was angry, not really at the nurse or at Steves, whom he realized had probably saved his life, but at the situation and at his own helplessness. And at the realization that his political rivals were almost certainly plotting, if not already deep into efforts to unseat him, to seize power for themselves. He didn't have time to lay around in some hospital, but if he couldn't even turn his head without vomiting, he was stuck.
No time to stay ill.
First Citizen, you have 6 broken ribs, a partially repaired punctured lung, multiple internal injuries, second-level radiation sickness. You have to stay here. Tell me what you need and I'll take care of it.
Steves, thank you. Help me now, and you will be rewarded.
Villeneuve detested being helpless, but he was a cold realist, and like it or not, he was completely dependent on Steves and on his guards. He'd managed to get a glimpse of one of the sentries outside his door. Steves had gotten his red shirts. The elite team was loyal, he was sure of that, though he realized an enemy only had to turn one of them to pull off a quick assassination.
He wasn't exactly a hard target lying in bed. I did everything I could think of, but...
You did. Well, now I need my people. We need to reassert control. Lucien, Pepien, Velachon, to start. Find them, and bring them here.
Steve's was silent for a few seconds. They're dead, First Citizen. All except for Velchon. I couldn't find him. He's probably dead too, but I haven't been able to confirm.
Villeneuve nodded, stopping the move halfway when his stomach rebelled again. He was alive for the moment, but unless he could get back in control, he wasn't likely to stay that way. He had to find out which of his reliable people were still alive. Assuming he could consider anyone reliable.
Andre, thank you so much for coming. What happened was a nightmare, a terrible atrocity on our city.
Ciara was sitting on a large couch, trying to look less weak and injured than she was. The townhouse belonged to Pierre Chantrel, an old ally and a former lover. She'd gambled wildly, bet her life that Chantrel would help her, that he, too, would place a wager with monumental stakes. If she prevailed and seized power, Chantrel would become her top industrial advisor, and no doubt shortly after that, the wealthiest man in the Union. Contacting André Velachon had been her second audacious bet, a far riskier one. Velachon was one of Villeneuve's key people, a longtime ally of the First Citizen. But Ciara was well-versed in driving wedges between friends and comrades, and her overture to Velachon had been accompanied by the daring claim that Villeneuve was in hiding somewhere, and that none other than the First Citizen himself had orchestrated the bombing in a fit of paranoia after the coup attempt, an effort to eliminate some of those close to him who might be tempted to emulate her actions. It was wild. Hard to believe. But then Velachon knew Villeneuve very well, and the whole fiction was something the First Citizen's ruthless mind just might conceive. Anyway, Velachon had come, and in a few minutes she'd know if he was serious about listening to her proposal, or if he'd simply taken the chance to get close so he could kill her. The reports on the street proclaimed the First Citizen was fine and in total control of the government, but Velachon's arrival told Ciara that wasn't true. Or certainly that it wasn't the whole story. Then her guest hit her with a bombshell. Gaston Villeneuve was caught in the explosion, but he is alive. Velachon's tone was neutral. She was usually good at reading people, but this time she had nothing. She figured it was about 50-50 whether he was there to discuss backing her efforts to seize power, or to put her down and collect his reward from Villeneuve. The odds had been better a few seconds before, when she had known for sure the First Citizen had survived. She'd heard the media reports, of course, about Villeneuve being unharmed, but she hadn't believed them for an instant. If he'd been unharmed, he'd have been all over the broadcast nets.
He must be injured, at least. That is unfortunate.
She glanced up at Velachon, and in that moment, she let her guard down and prepared to accept her fate, whatever it was.
So did you come to talk?
Or are there 100 fourrés rouges surrounding the house? I imagine from your perspective that may seem the likelier option, and very probably it would have been, save for one fact. I have known Gaston Villeneuve for a long time, and I have seen him during crises. I was by his side after the collapse of the Presidium, when he seized sole power. I watched him execute thousands as he solidified his base, including many loyal Sector 9 operatives, sacrificed because it was politically expedient for him to represent himself as new and separate from the old regime. That was all a fraud, of course, but I haven't forgotten. I think he was truly friends with Ricard Lié, but I don't believe the man has ever had a relationship with anyone else that wasn't